The Senate's building will run on House time. We'll get going. Members, welcome to the environment. I don't know if we're, I guess we can use, Senator Rosen is here, I saw her. We can use the word energy too. So this is going to be the Environment, Energy, Natural Resources Conference Committee. I'm Denny McNamara, chair of the House Environment Committee. I think what we'll actually do, Mr. Eloff, why don't we start with you? We better run around because there's a number of faces here that aren't familiar. We're going to go around. We'll get introduced, and first I'll let Senator Engelbretson introduce himself, and then we'll go back to you, Mr. Eloff.
Well,
Senator Engelbretson.
Welcome, everybody, and welcome, Denny, to the Senate side here. We certainly are looking forward to the dialogue today. We have commissioners coming forth, I think, after we get through our walkthrough here, talking about Commissioner Landwehr at 9 o'clock, Rothman at 9:30, John Jasky at 10 o'clock, and Commissioner Austin at 11 o'clock, and then we'll do the walkthrough side by side of the bill. So, again, I'm the chair of the Environmental Natural Resource Committee, and welcome to everybody.
Bob Eloff, House Research.
Janelle Taylor, House Research.
Jim Reinholtz, House Fiscal Analysis Department.
Representative Paul Torkelson, Vice Chair of the House Committee.
Mike Harris, Committee Legislative Assistant.
Amy Rudolph, Committee Administrator.
Mike Carbo, Committee Administrator.
Greg Knapp, Senate Analyst.
Beth Gallery, Committee Legislative Assistant.
Dan Mueller, Senate Fiscal.
Julie Rosen.
John Peterson, Senator from St. Cloud.
Gary Dames, Senate District 21.
Ed Werner, Senate Republican Research. All right, I think what we'll do, folks, we'll start with Mr. Reinholtz, and we'll start going through the side-by-sides, the spreadsheets, and we'll work with that until the different commissioners show up. And then as the commissioners show up, some of them we have letters from them. I believe I just got the PCA letter, and I believe we had maybe Commerce and DNR already, or not Commerce. We had, yes, Commerce, I believe. Commerce and DNR letters are in our possession, some of their comments on the bill. Just for folks, Senator Engelbretson and I did talk this morning. We are serious. This is for real now. We are moving forward. We want this to happen. We're very appreciative of all of the commissioners. I think it shows the seriousness of this going forward right now, and them all accommodating us. I know at least two of them are whipping out of here in a hurry to get outstate or coming from outstate at functions that were already scheduled. So we look forward to working with them. We've had a decent relationship up to this time. We understand the intense situation we're under and all the challenges going forward, but we're going to find a way to make it happen, and hopefully in the right timing. Mr. Reinholdt.
Mr. Chairman, members, I would refer you to the spreadsheet. Hopefully you have the tab spreadsheet in your books. The title of the spreadsheet is SF1029-HF1010, and dated in the corner should be 4-7-2001. This spreadsheet lays out both the Senate and the House positions, mostly the change items. And Mr. Chairman, I'm assuming we'll follow the typical procedure. Is I'll go through this and be pointing out the change items, particularly in the 2012-2013 years between point out the difference between the Senate and the House. And that would really be the column.
But the columns aren't titled, I guess. It'd be the column. The sixth column from the right, titled House minus Senate, is the one that will show you the differences. This first page is a summary at the agency level, so I'll run down through those. The Pollution Control Agency, the difference there is $5,770,000, in which the House is below the Senate. The Department of Natural Resources, the House below the Senate by $6,128,000. Met Council, House below the Senate, $358,000. Conservation Corps House is over the Senate by 455,000. Board of Water and Soil Resources House below the Senate, 2,174,000. In the Minnesota Zoo House over the Senate, 622,000. I should have said these are just the general fund numbers. It's general fund summary right now. So if you look at the net general fund for what is the Article 1 titled here, it's the environment area. You'll see that the house spending net general fund, $195,716,000. The Senate, $203,931. That brings the house at $8,215,000 below the Senate on the net. Moving down into where it's the commerce and energy area, you'll see that the number there, the $2,600,000, the House is below the Senate. Public Utilities Commission, $1,500,000, the House is below the Senate. In the net general fund area, in the Articles 3 and 4, was Article 2 in the House version, the energy area, the House has a net of $32,350,000. The Senate has a net of $18,676,000, so the House $13,674,000 over. The huge difference there is in created in where the transfers, and I'll get into the detail and show those later. The Senate had significantly more dollars transferred from special revenue and various accounts to the general fund. Just go down and hit the last number then to give an overall view. The net general fund, Senate is $222,607,000 is the net for the 12-13 year. The House is $228,066,000. $5,456,000 is the difference between the two. Move on to the second page. Now we're moving into the more detailed area by each agency. And what we've got, this spreadsheet starts out with the base amount by the fund and then lists each one of the changes in both positions, House and Senate positions, and where they have, and shows where there's differences. I think normally we just go through the differences, if that's what I'll do, unless someone on the conference committee who wants more detail, please interrupt.
Mr. Reinholz, I just want to make sure that we're going to go at Mr. Reinholz's pace and just deal with the changes, but any members that have questions, let us know and we'll interrupt. But it's our hope to not only accommodate all four commissioners today, but to get through not only the spreadsheet, but the language side by sides today. And I understand this room is reserved at noon for a different committee, so that's our hope. But we will go, if we don't get through that pace to accommodate members, we'll go like that. Any questions on that? All right. Oh, and you know what? As long as we've broken, I see Commissioner Landwehr is here. Why don't we bring the commissioner forward as long as we're broke? Commissioner Landwehr, I believe that we have a letter from you in our possession, or are we getting it passed out here to the pages? No. We have the commissioner's letter. Welcome, Commissioner Landwehr. If you could identify yourself for the record, I appreciate you accommodating your schedule. I know you're scheduled to be out of town.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Landwehr. I'm the Commissioner of Natural Resources. Very much appreciate the opportunity to be before you today. I know you all have the letter. I'm going to not read the letter to you since you all have it for reference, but I'll give you a little bit of summary of the information that's in there. First off, I'd like to say I understand the gravity of the situation you're working with and very much appreciate the ability to work with you all on dealing with the budget crisis that we're facing, and appreciate the task at hand, and that we will be doing some reorganizing as a result of this. Just as a way of background, I'd like to note that in FY 2000, the department's budget was about 48% general fund, and in FY 10, the department's budget was about 18% general fund. So over the years, the department has both cut general fund expenditures as well as shifted costs onto more dedicated sources of funding. And an example of that, of course, is our hunting and fishing license fees, which support our division of Fish and Wildlife, as well as several other activities within the department. And so we today are faced with a general fund contribution to the department of about 18% of our total revenues falls pretty heavily on three divisions. That is the divisions of Park and Trails, the division of Forestry, and the division of Ecological and Water Resources. So when we're looking at the impacts of the proposed reductions on the department, those are the three divisions that are going to see most of the results in. So I'm going to cover some of those today. I'd also take a moment to mention that the Game and Fish Fund, we've got pending in for consideration the Hunting and Fishing Heritage Bill, as well as the general fund budget here that would increase hunting and fishing license fees and provide several new licensing options that would help keep the Game and Fish Fund in the black for several more years. It's been 10 years since we've had a general increase in our hunting and fishing license fees, and so we're hoping as well that we can get some movement of that in the legislature. So, Mr. Chairman, if I could, I'd like to start out with a description of environmental review and permitting. Of course, we had quite a bit of discussion earlier in the session about HF1, the permitting expedience provision. And I recall sitting before many of you and expressing that we are all in favor of expediting permitting process, but it would be challenging if we see a reduction in the staffing in our permitting ranks. And in fact, that's what we're seeing with the budgets before us. The impacts that we will see as a result of the reductions in the Ecological and Water Resources falls heavily on our environmental review staff and our water permitting staff. And these are two areas where we have most of our permitting authority is in the environmental review, environmental impact statement review, and in the water appropriation permitting process. So as the letter suggests, I would expect that that will not help help us get to the goals of HF1. The bills do not provide for the department recovering the full cost of aquatic plant management permitting. Again, here's an example of how we could shift costs of doing business to the benefitees of doing business. That would be the aquatic plant management applicants. The bills do not allow us to do that. And shifting a little bit to aquatic invasive species, or invasive species management rather, the proposed budgets will reduce our ability to do terrestrial invasive species management on some state lands. The aquatic invasive species management, of course, is another subject completely. We very much appreciate the legislature's willingness to look for one-time funding for us. However, as you all know, this is a long-term problem, and we do fully expect that we will be dealing with aquatic invasive species 5 years out, 10 years out, 20 years out, and we really do look to you for a long-term source of funding for aquatic invasive species management. Underwater management, many of us breathed a sigh of relief, I think, at the first signs that the floodwaters were receding across the state. Many of you realize that the reason we had a very good outcome from this year's flooding is because we had a lot of advance warning. We knew the floods were coming. We knew we could tell where they were going to crest. We could tell what lands were going to be impacted. Much of that information and much of the protections that we've applied over the years to, in particular, the Red River Valley, have been a direct result of our water management capabilities, both our ability to identify floodplains, work with local units of government to get building code, zoning that would prevent building in floodplains, help people get the flood insurance they need, but as well to set up a very elaborate network of monitoring stations around the state so that we can follow the flood crests down the waterways of the state and predict what the flood elevations are going to be. Those are the types of activities that we fund out of our water management programs, and those are the types of activities that we will see some reduction in. Timber management, if you live in the northeastern part of the state, you know that the economy is driven by what we call the three T's: timber, tourism, and taconite. Much of our forest lands in the northern part of the state are, of course, state forest lands, public forest lands. This time in the sort of timber cycle, the timber industry is looking very heavily at state lands for providing timber because the private landowners think that the timber is worth more than the current market will bear. So we are trying to meet our goal of putting 800,000 cords of timber on the market, primarily for private industry. The proposal in the House will result in a reduction in our forest staffing that will have an immediate reduction in our ability to put up timber, and we're looking at about 85,000 cords, which is one-tenth of our annual goal of 800,000 cords. And the timber folks tell me that 100,000 cords is about four loggers in the woods, and Representative Dill may be able to speak better than that, but it is obviously it has a ripple effect to the whole economy of northern Minnesota. The second T, tourism, when we look at the proposals in the House or Senate versions, we're looking at mothballing. We say mothballing because we don't ever close these. People can always go walk into a state park and use a state park, but we would mothball 5 to 7 state parks. That means we would no longer have any presence in terms of staff there. We would close the gates and put up signs advising people are on their own. We would anticipate reducing year-round services on another 4 to 6 state parks. We would reduce spring and fall operations on another 4 to 6 state parks. And we would reduce work on our non-motorized trails. As you know, we have a very elaborate and well-used trail system, both from the standpoint of snowmobiles as well as bike trails in the state, and these are managed by the state, and we'll see some reduction as a result of both of these Senate and House versions. Under the Senate version, we would reduce our public outreach and interpretive services and reduce our road and facility maintenance operations as well. The Senate has proposed shifting $3 million from a Environment and Natural Resource Trust Fund proposal into operations. We appreciate, again, the willingness of the legislature to look for alternative sources of funding. Again, we're not sure this source of funding allows us to cover operational expenses, such as cleaning restrooms, which are good, bad, or indifferent, a big part of our daily operations. Neither the House or the Senate version includes funding for the Division of Enforcement to retain our full complement of officers or to implement our academy, our Enforcement Academy, which would allow us to bring in a new complement of officers. So we would continue to operate at quite a substantial reduction in our enforcement ranks. Finally, I would again offer that we are looking at the Hunting and Fishing Heritage Heritage Enhancement Initiative as a critical part of the equation. The users that we talk to regularly, the hunting and fishing groups, as evidenced by the Budget Oversight Committee and the Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance and others, have indicated support for this. So we think we've got the hunting and angling community understanding the need for the increase. And we also have pending the consideration for an aquatic invasive species initiative that will be funded by revenue from a surcharge on boats, and we will implore you to also consider those as funding needs going forward as well. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I will wrap up my comments. I would be welcoming your questions, and Mr. Chairman, I stand for questions at this time.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Commissioner, for being here today and giving everybody the overview here. We certainly appreciate your letter. I think it details it pretty well where we're at here. I do have some questions, and I'm also some comments, I guess. I'm glad to see that we're talking about mothballing 5 to 7 parks versus shutting 27 parks. I'm glad to see that we've worked through that verbiage there, knowing very well that the parks belong to the public, and I don't think we can even actually shut the parks, but that was a worry at one time. And I think in general, just a general comment. I think folks are going to expect some of those things to happen with a $5 billion deficit looming over our heads. So the questions I have on your enforcement, what's your CO, your conservation officer complement now versus full complement?
Commissioner Landry.
Chairman, members of the committee, I believe, and I'm speaking from memory here, which is dangerous in my case, but I believe our full complement is about 175 officers. We are down 22 officers right now, and we anticipate 10 retirements in the next year. So we will be down to, I believe we're down to about 150, give or take now, and we will see another 10 reduction in that. So we will be down 30 to 35 officers in the next year.
If the funding Senator Engelbertson.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. If the funding were available, when would you have your academy?
Commissioner Landwehr.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I believe we'd have the academy this fall. We'd start right away.
Senator Engelbertson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Let's shift over to the fees for the again, that's something that's been thrown around that we should be looking at increasing fees. We're also under the impression that hunting and fishing fees, it's been suggested by the committee that actually oversees that, the Citizens Committee that oversees that, that particular fund, Game and Fish Fund, won't be into the red until 2014. Can you comment a little deeper on that, and maybe you could tell us what remaining money you do have in that account?
Mr. Chairman,
Commissioner Landwehr.
At current rate of expenditure, we expect to go in the red. I believe it's 2014, 2015. It's not a precise date, obviously. A couple of issues around that. One is that it takes time to both implement a fee increase and start seeing those revenues come in, as well as to we have the issue that we will be looking at with this budget, be looking at shifting some additional expenses to the Game and Fish Fund. Now, an example of that, before people get too concerned, is that we have a significant number of wildlife management areas that have timber on them. In the past, when we have done a timber sale on these wildlife areas, and in a vision, we have a number of places that people like to hunt grouse. If you're going to hunt grouse, you need to hunt in timber that's 30 years old or less, typically. So we sell timberland on wildlife management areas in order to maintain that habitat. Our foresters from the Division of Forestry will go out and set up that timber sale. They will scale that timber sale. They will oversee all aspects of that. In the past, when the Division of Forestry has done that, they have paid for that out of general fund dollars. So that it's been a general funded activity in the past. Because of the significant reductions to the Division of Forestry, we're proposing that when they do a timber sale on a state wildlife area, that the Division of Fish and Wildlife should reimburse the Division of Forestry for that expense. So as a result of that shift that we're going to be doing, which we think is an appropriate shift over the next couple of years, that will have the effect of driving that Game and Fish Fund into the red quicker, because we're now leaning more heavily on it. We're trying to get more expenses into that account. So that projection of 2015 would be under the current expense accounting system. Going to the new expense accounting system will bring that up sooner, and our ability to generate revenues as a result of the fee increase obviously won't kick in until a year from now.
Senator Engelbertson.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So what you're saying is that you're going to be in the red a year from now? Is that fair?
Commissioner Landwehr.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, it depends on what happens here today, frankly. If we retain more general fund money, we may not have to shift as much expense. If we have less general fund money, we may have to shift more expense. But I think we're looking at 2013 to 2014 in general as being the years in which the account will go into the red under the current scenario without a hunting and fishing license increase.
Senator Engelbertson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's shift over to the aquatic invasive species you talked about. Commissioner, that we're looking at prioritization all through state government, and I think counties and cities are doing the same. But when you talk about, and maybe you can familiarize the committee with regards to aquatic and dryland invasive species, if you had a choice of spending dollars right now with emerging issues such as aquatic and invasive species, including the flying carp. Would you tell me how you would deal with that? Would dry land be able to put be so-called mothballed for a year or two, or would that be irresponsible, or would that be something that could be done and more target on aquatic as well as the our Asian carp situation that everybody's talking about? Could you get some comments on that?
Commissioner Lanwear.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, in many cases, when we're talking about terrestrial invasive species management, you know, farmers call those weeds, right? When they're on the ground,
right,
we call them weeds. And we have a statutory obligation, obviously, on wildlife management areas to control weeds, you know, state-listed noxious weeds. So two things happen when we don't do that, obviously. First off, we get a lot of complaints that we're not controlling weeds on state land. Second off, you allow those weeds to expand, and so they become a greater problem in the future. The aquatic invasive species, and you have heard two aspects of the aquatic invasive species this year. One is a policy bill that gives us more authority to do inspections, greater penalties for people in violation, and so on. I believe that's proceeding intact. The other is the funding, because aquatic invasive species control largely becomes an individual responsibility. We have to get boaters in particular to understand that when they move a boat from one water body to another, they have to make sure they're not bringing along any aquatic species with them. In order to do that, we need to educate people about what to look for. We need to have appropriate fines and inspection capability out there to do that. And more stakeholders are suggesting we should be using decontamination stations. So what you see in those proposals is a lot of that. It's ramping that up to allow for us to do a better job of working with boaters in particular to manage this resource. In both cases, I mean, good, bad, or indifferent, in both cases, it's sort of like tooth decay. If you ignore it, it doesn't get any better, and it's going to cost more when you go to the dentist next time.
Senator Engelbrecht.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more question. I've taken up everybody's time here. I don't mean to do that. Could you talk just real briefly about the, in the Senate portion of the bill, about the proposed nursery closure a little bit, how that will affect you?
Commissioner Lanwear.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the state runs two nurseries right now. As I think everybody knows, the Vidora State Nursery and the General Andrews State Nursery. Both nurseries, and I had a chance to visit both of them last week, provide bare root stock for not only reforestation of state land, but also through local units of government like soil and water conservation districts, two counties for reforestation of state, county forest lands, and ultimately some go to private buyers as well through the soil and water conservation districts. In addition to growing those trees, what the nurseries do is they are a storehouse of very important genetic material. The Division of Forestry, and through the nurseries every year, collects millions of acorns from southeastern Minnesota and other places where we have oak trees. They collect millions of pine cones from the northern part of the state, from locally identified places, and keep those tagged for their local identification so that we have the ability, when we are talking about reforesting an Aitkin County tract or a Couchiching County tract, we can find seed and trees, bare root stock, that came from those local places most ideally suited to those locations. So the nurseries perform a very valuable function that is not, to my knowledge, done in the retail sector. And Chairman McNamara can correct me if I'm mistaken there, where we can tell you exactly where this seed came from. We can put it exactly in the best spot based on its origin. And it's source tag material is what the state nurseries provide in a bare root fashion, which is something that's used a lot on particular types of planting. So the bills differ in the outcomes for the nurseries, but I think the intention of both bills is that we should ultimately be closing the state nurseries, which I think we would find some significant problems with respect to providing that source tagged material.
Senator Engelbrecht.
Real quickly, so without the privates having the ability to do that, or the need, quite frankly, in other words, if the DNR having the corner on the market for the harvesting of those seeds you talk about, there really would be no need for the privatization or the private sector to be doing that. However, they would do that if they were given a chance. Is that a fair statement?
Mr. Lanwear.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my understanding is we have tried to work in the past with getting source tagging and bare root stock and have not had a private sector rise up to meet that need. So I think the department went to a cap years ago to 10 million trees, and then now we're working under 6 million trees, and have not seen a concomitant rise in the provision of that by the private sector. Again, it's bare root stock, which is not something the private nurseries work a lot with.
Thank you very much, Commissioner.
Commissioner Landwehr, why don't we follow up a little bit more as long as we're on the nursery topic. As you said, there's a couple of functions, I think, if we put them, that the DNR tree nurseries do. They have the function of research and collaboration with the university. That's a very small part, but probably one of the most important parts, and we certainly need to find a way to make sure that that research continues. There's valuable knowledge within the DNR, the university, and the private sector about a number of things, and we do need to realize the very significant importance of zoning and viability and the seed collection. You're right, white spruce collected and Representative Dill's region of the boreal forest are very different than white spruce from sandstone or wherever. So that's really, really important work. You talked about that seed collection, but the actual seed collection, who actually does that work?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the department actually buys the seeds from individuals. So we put out a notice that we're looking for so many acorns from a certain area or so much conifer seed from a certain area, and then people come to us and they sell it to us. So that's one of the... We talk about the financing of how this nursery works. This is one of those things where we have a net out-of-pocket expense because we're buying all these seeds, and there's processing that's required. When you think of a pine cone, you have to get a pine cone before it pops open. So we get these pine cones when they're closed and they're tight, and we have to process them over a period of a year, essentially, to get those seeds out. And then we plant the seeds, and we have them in the ground for 3 years. So it's 4 years from the point of our initial expenditure before we actually have a tree that we can produce. But they are, you know, it's just like Christmas boughs. You think of, you know, the Christmas trees that people have. People go and cut those things often from state forests, or they collect these pine cones from state or private land. They bring them to us. We pay them, so it is a source of income for some people in parts of Minnesota.
Well, Commissioner, that was my point. It's important for... I think folks in the audience may think that they're DNR foresters out there picking up the acorns. These are actually hardworking private sector people. They're already doing that. So I think it shows that the private sector is involved, and they're the ones that – so it's not the DNR forestry police making sure that these seeds are coming from this exact spot. The private sector already is involved in that, trustworthy, part of the process. And it's our point we need to look at to see could more of this – be the private sector, and what role does government have in competing with the private sector in this nursery business, and at what level should they? We have the research, we have the seed collection, and then the actual production at a time of year when many people in this industry this week, when we're in probably the middle, their most intense time, are working 80 hours a week under conditions of today. It's a beautiful day out, even though we're in the basement here. These folks are going to work 14, 16 hours a day, and I see some of them in the audience right now that have been through that. Mm-hmm. I don't think of, when I think of that, having been in an industry somewhat similar to this for over 30 years, I don't, and being raised in a family where my father worked for state government, mm-hmm. I don't see that this is the kind of thing that we normally think of state employees in a business where the vast majority of the work is done in, say, 8 to 12 week period. We have state employees doing that work. I think we need to evaluate, is this the correct role? That being said, Commissioner, we are not going to have a situation where Senator Engelbrightson and I are responsible that trees don't get planted on public land because we did something very silly in 2011. So we look forward to working with you on this issue. It's a tough issue. You've been on a path for the last couple of years that would put you in violation of state law shortly. You're going to run out of the balance in the forest nursery account based on the path that we've gone for the last couple of years. And so we need to correct it and work together to find a solution. I think looking at the private sector more makes sense, realizing, as you talked about, the importance of research, seed collection, and the availability of plant material on public land. On private land, the private sector is available, especially in the deciduous market. But and maybe for the whole thing, the Senate's raised a good scenario of looking at different alternatives. You made a point to say we have, over the next few years, we have to deal with this issue. So it's just one small part of the issues before us. I think, Commissioner, before you leave, I've got a couple other comments, but I'd like to go to some of the other members. Representative Dill.
Thank you, Chair McNamara. Commissioner, thank you for coming today. I wanted to go back to the enforcement part of your letter. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, how is the full complement? I've been here 9 years, and I think all 9 years that I've served on this committee and over all of these years served on, I think, every conference committee, and I have repeatedly heard the department testify that they have a full complement that is significantly greater than what is actually in force in the field. How is that full complement determined? And it seems to be, at least, it seems to be a moving target.
Commissioner Landwehr.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, when you look at a map of the state of Minnesota, we have a number of stations for enforcement officers. I don't know the exact number of stations out there, but each enforcement officer has, you know, one or part of one county or two counties. They have a geographic area they have. So when you look at the map of the state right now and you look at all of these work areas, there are some significant holes. And they tend to be in northern Minnesota. I prefer not to identify specifically where they are because then that sort of invites the poaching element to get out there. But full complement means that none of those offices is unoccupied. Each one of those offices has an enforcement officer in it. Now, not all of our officers are in the field, of course. We have a supervisory structure so that we have a district supervisor who will oversee several officers, and we have a training program. You know, it's a regular police force, so there is an infrastructure behind the field force, but the majority of our officers are field officers.
Follow-up, Representative Dill.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Well, so how often, I'm going to ask two questions at once so we can speed this up a little bit. How often has this complement been accomplished in the last decade? And secondly is how are retirements versus new recruitments going to affect enforcement, particularly in light of this proposed budget?
Commissioner Landwehr.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, unfortunately, I can't tell you the last time there was a full complement, Representative Dill. I'll have to get that information. But I know that the department has had one or two academies in the last decade, and the intention of the academy, we don't just hire for one spot. We take an academy because there's, you know, significant specialized training that officers have to go through. So we have an academy where we bring a full group of new officers through, and it'll be 20 to 30 officers that go through an academy at one point in time. And we have had one or two academies in the last decade that was intended to get us to full complement. So if I'm not mistaken, we have in the past decade probably been at full complement. But then we're faced at the same time with ongoing retirements. We always have retirements every year. And, you know, so if you do hit full complement, it tends to not be for very long. Now, we can live with less than full complement for short periods of time, but the prospect we're facing right now is not just a large number of vacancies, 22 vacancies, but the prospect in the near term of another 10 retirements. So retirements, to your second point, Representative Dill, as anybody who's stepped in the DNR knows, we have an aging workforce, and my understanding is that a third of our workforce is going to be retiring in the next 5 to 10 years, and that is equally true for enforcement officers who have an earlier retirement age. So we will have, even while we're looking at a new academy coming through, retirements in addition to those 10, that by the time we get those 22 current vacancies filled, we will probably have more vacancies. It's not unexpected. It's not intolerable. It's just like, you know, they say 4% unemployment rate is healthy because it means people are moving around from job to job, and I would anticipate some vacancies to always be present in the department.
Representative Dill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to switch to parks for a moment, if I may. How would the closures be determined? And then secondly is how would the reduction in services be determined under the proposed budget.
Commissioner Landwehr.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I've asked our parks people to start thinking about that. We don't have a process in place. It will have to be a public process in both cases, whether it's a closure or a reduction in services. There are any number of metrics we can look at. We can look at number of visitors. We can look at expense per visit. We could look at the ratio of income to expense. You know, many of our parks are $50,000 a year general fund expense because we have enough income from the park that it offsets the operating expenses. So we don't have a good proposal to offer you today as to how those would be closed, but we would have to develop criteria, and we'd have to go through a public process to determine that, recognizing that, you know, July 1 is coming very quickly, and that could be the time we have to start considering this. I have asked our Division of Parks and Trails to start figuring out what that public process will be and what those criteria will be. We have some, you know, Itasca is $1 million a year park, very expensive. You know, we could solve $1 million problem with one park, but obviously Itasca is not going to be a park where we're going to close or reduce services at.
Representative Deal.
Well, one more area, Mr. Chair, at this time, in the law, in the forest products division of the budget. And just doing some quick calculations, it looks like the way this is proposed, it would be about 10,000 truckload, 9 to 10,000 truckloads of wood that would be reduced from the supply. And as you stated, people such as myself think that the wood that's on my land is more valuable than the current market. So I'm not a seller. I'm actually a buyer. And I suspect, so my real question is has the DNR looked at what the pressure on the price might be to mills if 10,000 truckloads of wood is taken out of the supply? And where I'm going with this is if the budget requires a reduction in this division and there's less wood put up and the price goes up, how does that go to the competitiveness of our industry in this global economy? And secondly, have the mills articulated to you the importance of their need for this 10,000 roughly truckloads of wood and their possible non-investment or looking at other areas or countries or parts of this United States that they may begin to invest in if Minnesota walks steps backward from our tradition, at least in the last decade, of 800,000 cords of off of state land?
Commissioner Landwehr.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, last week I had a good opportunity to visit both the Bemidji Forestry Affairs Council and the Grand Rapids Forestry Affairs Council, so talk to industry people, you know, all the way from independent contract loggers to the mill operator of the UPM Bland Mill. So we were able to talk about a lot of issues, and there's great concern about a reduction below 800,000. 800,000 cords is sort of the state's commitment to put up on state land to the private sector. And understand loggers can get timber from federal lands, from county lands, and from private lands. But to the earlier point, private landowners right now are reluctant to sell because aspen is selling for currently about $20 a cord. Not that long ago, people could get $100 a cord, and I heard of one sale that was $120 a cord. So if you were an owner who once upon a time thought your wood was worth $100 a cord and it's currently selling for $20, you're not selling. And that's what the loggers are facing right now, is there is no private timber available because people are unwilling to sell it at that rate. The federal government is putting timber out, but they're very working under different hurdles there as well. So the state and the counties right now are currently the source of choice. I've not heard of what a reduction in the state allocation or the state availability would do to prices. But what I have heard is perhaps more to your point, and that is that there is an expectation for a long-term supply of 800,000 cords of wood a year from state lands in Minnesota. And timber is a global industry. When timber prices were up, we saw a lot more interest in foreign wood. So Canadian wood was being purchased, overseas wood was being purchased. When timber prices are down like they are now, they're leaning more on state lands. And when they are looking at where they are going to invest in infrastructure, this being a global company, and UPM Kimini, as you know, is a Finnish company, and SAPI, that we have an international global industry right now. When they're looking at investing, they want to invest in a place where they have certainty of wood source. And when they can't be certain that they're going to be able to get 800,000 cords of wood in Minnesota, it colors their decision about where they're going to invest. And that's what I heard from several industry representatives last week, is if they can't have certainty that there will be 800,000 cords of timber available in Minnesota, and their corporate board has to look at that, it's a factor in their decision-making about where they're going to invest, and it can very easily lead to investment in other countries, as happened with UPM not that long ago. So the concern is that, if we can't put that much timber up, we will lose future investment in the industry.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Dill, you're done. Commissioner, just a follow-up, and Representative Dill, we've had this conversation with industry. I would imagine they're in the audience today. Just because, and I know you've talked about different divisions paying back to forestry, and I think that's on the right track, that we should have the different divisions paying back to forestry. But I also think, Commissioner, we need to push the envelope. The idea that we have to just have DNR foresters going out, and where I deer hunt in Representative Dill's district, the red paint has a different meaning than the blue paint. But the reality, many of your former DNR foresters that have now reached retirement are available, and many of them, and some, I should say, working in the private sector. We should be looking at more ways of the private sector doing this work. There's some innovative programs out there where we could go forward and get the logging done, but not necessarily with the absolute oversight mechanism that we've used in the past. These foresters are going to training, going to classes, certification, and such, and it's happening in the private sector. And I hope that you're looking at that possibility as we go forward with a number of the folks in state government that are like my age and getting ready to move on, that potentially we can replace them in a different way that still gets the logging happening. But this idea that we have to do it just because this is how we did it in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and such, that we would not look at a different way. And you've changed lots of the processes there. I'm impressed with the selective cutting and the softer, but so much has changed, and I just want to really push the agency forward, just not to say, well, you know, we've had this much money in the past, we got to have this much money to accomplish the same task. We need to be innovative, think of other ways as we go forward. I don't know if you have a short comment on that,
Commissioner. Mr. Chairman,
we'd
short,
like to,
just a very
we'd like
short
to wrap
comment.
You up in 10 more minutes. Commissioner Landwehr.
I agree with you very much, and the Forestry Division currently is looking at new models of doing business, and I fully expect that 10 years from now, the way we do timber management on state lands will be different than the way it is today. The challenge is just how quickly we can get there, because we have a system in place right now that that is, as you say, has been in place for a long time. It's hard to change very quickly.
Well, Commissioner, I agree with your statement. I would just take the zero off the number of years. Representative Dill.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I want to just add on to that. When I look at the boreal forest up there and the ownership challenges, it would seem to me that we should be looking at something. And I tried to advance this a bit when I was the chair of the committee, looking at working so that timber companies that had large holdings of land where state has large holdings of land, that we should be looking at creating kind of a vast tract of land that maybe the private industry operates, or let's say where we have a lot of tax forfeit, St. Louis County example, over almost 1 million acres of tax forfeit, we should have the county working on the state land so that we can take our resources, our state resources, and use them more where we can get a better bang for the buck. And I'm not being critical about how you've done this in the past particularly, and I don't know that 1 year is the right time frame, but I'm not sure I agree with you that 10 is the right time frame either. But those are the kinds of innovative things that I think that we got to look at to keep the wood going to the mills at a reasonable rate. Thank you.
And Representative Dill, in a responsible manner. It doesn't have to be necessarily by the DNR. Representative Dill.
Well, you know, there's essentially two certification methods for wood, and nobody will buy the wood unless it's certified. I mean, let's name a name. Time magazines, they won't buy the end product. Many others won't buy the end product unless our practices are certified and they're certified properly done. I mean, and this means every kind of management you can imagine, down to the mosquitoes.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Landwehr, could you just briefly outline the department's perspective on the development of Vermilion State Park and how that relates to the other state parks in the state?
Commissioner Landwehr.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think to summarize the current thinking, we've spent a lot of money acquiring this park. We should make it available to some level of public use. Now, under the current budget constraints, I recognize we're not going to get it to the point where it was envisioned a year ago in the next 3 years. But if we don't have some sort of use in there, even if it's just primitive use, in the next few years, I think people are going to wonder what the state was thinking. And good, bad, or indifferent, even primitive use requires some pretty complex infrastructure in terms of roads and water and sewer systems. So some of the basic infrastructure that needs to go in, even to have primitive camping, is still somewhat expensive.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, at the same time, I will have citizens wondering what the state's thinking as they close the park or mothball the park in their neighborhood at the same time as we're developing a park in another part of the state. So I have a little trouble explaining that to my constituents, and I hope that the department will keep that in mind as we proceed.
Well, and to that point, Representative Torkelson, when we see the TV ad that talks about buying a lottery ticket, you see pictures of the loons, and people think of state parks, and it's going to be kind of silly to say, well, we're going to be closing state parks while we're seeing the money that was raised through the lottery. And so that's a challenge for us, and the Senate's laid out something that we've got to think about. Senator Dames.
Chairman McNamara, Commissioner Landwehr, I'd like to go back to the enforcement side. In looking at the spreadsheet here, it appears that the amount of money that you received in the 2010-2011 biennium versus what's projected even at the House level is fairly comparable. And I understood you have a concern that you might have 10 more people retiring and the concern about filling those. Now, could you explain, if you have basically the same money, why you would lose, if you have 10 people retire, why you would not be able to replace basically all of them, because they would certainly, younger folks would certainly come in at a different salary range than what the retirees are. So could you explain that to me, please?
Commissioner Landwehr.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it goes back to, again, the notion that we don't just hire an individual for a job. When we fill vacancies in the force, we have an academy. So we look at, a year-long training program, essentially, for these officers, and they are not operating in a station the day we hire them. So we have, when we hold academy, of course, it's fairly expensive. We want to get as many people in there as possible. So if we can have a 25 or 30-member academy, that's the most cost-effective way of doing it. And then we have, the expenses of running the academy in addition to the expenses of hiring the people. So just having the salary savings for the positions does not give us the funding we need to hold an academy and put people into a position.
Chairman McNamara, follow-up.
Senator Dames.
Commissioner Landwehr, could you give me some idea the cost of running an academy in order to cultivate these prospective enforcement officers?
Commissioner Landwehr,
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Meyer,
Commissioner Landwehr. I'm going to lean on Mr. Meyer here to get into the details.
Mr. Meyer, welcome
Chairman,
to the committee.
Members,
identify yourself for the
thank
record.
You very much for the record. Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. And I'm going to refer you to, we'll make sure these get in your packets for the next time you meet, our whole packet of fact sheets that talk about all of our budget proposals. But this is outlined in the one that talks about our maintenance of natural resource enforcement and education and public safety. What we were proposing in the governor's budget was an academy of approximately 8 officers, which would cost about $920,000. And then going with that complement and adding an additional 12 more officers the following year, fiscal year 13, with the salaries and the training expenses, it would be an additional $2.5 million for that year. And then ongoing with that new 20 complement, it would be about $2.4 million per year in costs. That proposal was also tied to our Hunting and Fishing Heritage Initiative, which would provide additional revenue off of hunting and fishing licenses. So as Commissioner Landwehr had stated, the training costs and the salaries and the academy costs are approximately, for those eight officers with salary, $920,000 for FY12.
Senator Deans.
Chairman McNamara, follow up. Senator Landwehr and Mr. Meyer, or Commissioner Landwehr, excuse me, and Mr. Meyer, are there outside sources that could do this training?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, not that I'm aware of. I would have to ask Division Director Conrad, Colonel Conrad, if he would know all that. Maybe Senator Ingebrigtsen would know. This is pretty specialized training, and I think it's the kind of training you would lean on existing conservation officers to provide. But I honestly don't know.
Thank you.
Well, and Senator Dames, in the challenging times we're at, I hope, Commissioner, you're looking at the idea that oftentimes these are very coveted positions, and many of the folks that come into these have years of law enforcement experience. Many of them come from the field, either from where Senator Ingebrigtsen was, or some are from your own from our own state patrol officers that want to come. If I'm not mistaken, Representative Cornish was originally a deputy sheriff, I think, before he became, if I'm remembering correctly, before
Mr.
he became
Chairman,
a
virtually
CO.
All of our officers come, they have to come with police, peace officers certification. So they are typically coming from a sheriff's department, police department, or some other enforcement branch.
Well, and now I remember the one that just checked me recently or last season out in Big Stone County had moved from big city police and was very excited to be in that arena. But with the partnering with neighboring COs, potentially, if we can't afford the academy now, I think I'm hoping that you're looking forward over the next few weeks of being innovative along Senator Dames' thought process that we need to be real in this budget, and we need to think of ways that we can make this work. These COs not only are checking me to see if I've got an over-limited ducks, but they're going to be doing a lot of AIS work that's really, really important in this coming year. And we want to have those people on the ground as much as possible, realizing your total budget cut is, if I'm not mistaken, Commissioner Landwehr, in the area of 2%. Will you go out to the general public and talk to them that you're going to cut the budget by 2%, and they think of their home, their work, or their nonprofit, their church, and then you talk about closing 20% or whatever of the state parks, they're like, you know, let's find a way to work together. And so I guess, Commissioner, at this point, we do have a few other ones that have questions, but are you ready to get serious, and are you going to be here on behalf of Governor Dayton, and are we going to move this process forward, and are you empowered to speak for the governor and be here to really move this forward?
Mr. Chairman, a couple of points. First off, is, of course, the governor is asking me to give you our best advice, so I am empowered to come and talk to you about that. With respect to conservation officers, you know, if I come from a big city police department and I don't know my waterfowl, I don't know what an aquatic invasive species looks like, I don't know how to run a snowmobile, I'm going to be pretty darn effective, and I am not going to put our officers at risk by not providing them the correct training. We will have correct training. We won't put officers out there. We will look for ways to do things differently and more efficiently. And obviously, I've been on the job 3-4 months now. I can't attest to what we've done in the past, but I can attest that in the future, I am always going to be looking for the best way to get things done, the cheapest way to get things done, the most effective way to get things done. But we will have qualified people out there.
Thank you. Would you like to address the, on behalf of the governor, question?
To my earlier point, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the governor looks to me to provide the answer, so I am, in fact, speaking for the governor.
Well, thank you. And the times you can't be here, I look forward to Mr. Meyer or Deputy Commissioner Shad to be here, because we do want to move this forward. Representative Dill.
Thank you for allowing me another question. Commissioner, I guess I've never asked this question before over all these years, regarding license fee increases. And having served on the Board of Oversight, I have a reasonable understanding of the need for the balance and for the fact that it's going to go in the red and why it's going in the red. But how much more difficult have you analyzed I'm thinking about the competitiveness of our licenses regarding other states, because that's important to the, particularly the tourism sector. How much more difficult is it for us to manage our resources versus surrounding states? Is it more difficult because of the geography, because of access? In my district, I'm certain it's more expensive because of access. I mean, we don't have the roads that they have in other parts of the states. Has that been analyzed and been a component of how the proposal to increase fees has been developed?
Commissioner Landwehr.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm not aware of an analysis of sort of the cost and benefit of doing fisheries management in other states versus Minnesota. Of course, you know, North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa really are not places you would think of as fishing destinations. Wisconsin would perhaps be the closest. I don't know how the challenges that they face versus the expenses they face compared to ours. I think our biggest challenge is, frankly, we have 5,000 lakes that we manage for fisheries purposes. So we have this hugely diverse system. We have 1,600 public water accesses. There's another 1,500 public accesses owned by local units of government and so on. So we have this huge, you know, massive system that arguably is one of the best in the country. People come to Minnesota from all over, obviously, for fishing. And it's not because it's particularly good any one day for any one species, but you can come here and you may catch the next world record muskie. You can catch, I was down at Forest Hill State Park over the weekend. My son, my 13-year-old son, brought home 4 brown trout. I mean, this is an extraordinary resource we've got here in Minnesota. And it is in part extraordinary because of the geology of the state, but it's in part extraordinary because we've done a very good job, I believe, of managing fisheries in the state.
Thank you. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, you know, in looking at the Senate budget compared to the governor's budget, you know, we're just $1 million off, basically, really somewhere in the neighborhood of 0.5%. And I guess our friends from the House are a little bit more, maybe pushing 1%. I mean, when your conversations with the governor, how many parks did you tell the governor you'd have to close with his budget?
Commissioner Landwehr.
Members of the committee, again, I want to point out that the general fund is 18% of our budget. So when we talk about cutting 2% of the department's budget, yes, that is in fact true, but it does not reflect the fact that it is falling disproportionately on 3 divisions. The number that we've used in the past, it was 15 to 24 state parks, included the closures as well as the partial closures. And when you look at the numbers that are on that letter, we're talking about, you know, 5 to 7 complete closures, 4 to 6 partial closures, 4 to 6 seasonal closures. Those are the numbers we're talking about, and those are the numbers that the governor is working with. But that reduction, because parks is funded in large part by general fund money, is essentially 20 to 30% reduction for the Division of Parks and Trails.
So, follow up, Senator Peterson.
So if I can summarize, the governor was aware his budget was going to close 4 to 6 parks, probably.
Mr. Chairman,
Commissioner Landwehr.
Members of the committee, I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question. The governor's budget was a 10% reduction, and under that we would propose to reduce hours and shorten seasons at 5 state parks and recreational areas, and offer rustic-only camping year-round at 4 parks. So there were reductions in service at state parks under the governor's budget. That's correct.
Senator Peterson.
Yeah, that's what I call rereading as well, and I would encourage you, you know, in referencing Representative Torkelson's question, I myself will not have any trouble representing what's happening to my constituents, because I think you can do the same just by expanding that to further parks. And I would encourage you and your staff to look at what you just said in that letter, just expanding it to more parks to make up for this difference. I think it would be a grave mistake, you know, to close parks. And I won't have trouble representing that, because that's your decision with 0.5% or in regards to the budgets we have relating to the Senate or the House, compared to what our constituents have gone through, 0.5% or 1% in cost of those parks, whether it be in compensation or benefits or expenses or mileage reimbursements and things like that, is not an unreasonable reduction in order to keep our state parks open. And so I hope you're getting the message from this one senator that's got one vote, that would be, in my view, a grave mistake to go in that direction.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dingell, I'm sorry, Senator Peterson, were you done?
Yep. Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
You. Commissioner Landwehr.
Just a short comment, if I could, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It will be my personal priority that we minimize the impact on the citizens of the state, whatever we end up with here. So I'll give you that assurance. If we can get by doing seasonal closures, we will. One of the big unknowns here is, you know, what's happening in the state government finance bill. That's a 15% across-the-board reduction, and we haven't even factored that into the discussions we're talking about today. But that obviously that throws the gates open again. I don't have a good answer for how that would affect some of these operations.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, and Commissioner. I certainly appreciate the comments working through the governor with this group that cares so much about the environment here in Minnesota, and I look forward to working with you. I think sometimes we don't look at the good side as well, and I want to compliment the DNR on their handling of the bovine TB thing over the last years, and the most recently the chronic wasting disease situation we had down in Pine Island, where we that was handled very well. I don't think there was a complaint one that came from there. So your department handled that very well. That something that could have been very, very serious. It was attacked, and you're also you're strong going after the invasive species here, dealing with aquatics as well as that Asian carp thing that I think is on a lot of people's minds. We really appreciate your efforts there, as well as the governor's efforts to look at the immediacy of that as an emerging issue, and I certainly compliment you on that as well. So I look forward to working with you to get through this.
Thank you, Senator.
Thanks for coming in, Commissioner, and we know you've got other things going on. Next, we're going to hear from Commissioner Rothman. I see you're in the audience. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, I hope you get out fishing this weekend. Better have a raincoat.
I hope to go shooting with Representative Dillon.
Oh, good. Welcome, Commissioner Rothman. You. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Mike Rothman, Commerce Commissioner. Thank you for having me this morning. Really appreciate the opportunity, and here also to answer any questions at this point that you may have. So in general, Mr. Chair and members, let me start with a few overall observations about our budget that I'd like you to consider when you're convening and discussing it amongst yourselves in terms of the priorities. So I'll take you back to some of the comments that I made in committee, both in on the House side and as well on the Senate side. Overall, as you know, the Minnesota Department of Commerce is responsible for consumer protection of public interest in a variety of contexts. We regulate over 20 industries with the staff that we have. That includes state banks, insurance companies, a whole host of others, the securities industry, and as well the energy sector and the telecommunications sector. What I'd like to just remind folks when you're looking at the numbers for the Department of Commerce is that over the last 10 years, the budget of the Department of Commerce has been reduced to a point now where, before I started, a little over 100 days ago, the department was operating on a bare to the bone and lean operation. Imagine further cuts when you're already in a lean position, Mr. Chair. And to the credit of the prior administration, to my predecessor, he implemented with staff a significant amount of technology and efficiency changes in staffing reductions. And where we're at, and when we, from the governor's budget perspective, is that there are risks in going too far. The general funding for our department is nearly all staffing. And a reduction of staff will reduce our services and the work that we do in the product that we can do and protect consumers. I also want to point out that the Department of Commerce is unique among agencies, as many know, and that is in that we generate revenue from our department that goes back to the general fund with respect to civil penalties and fines and other areas. And therefore, a reduction in staffing translates to a net reduction in revenue to the general fund. It's an important concept, but sometimes overlooked, and needs to be considered by the members. We distributed a letter. The letter speaks for itself. We outlined some of the numbers and the impacts, not only to the staffing, but we also outlined some of the special fund balance cuts that are in both the House and the Senate proposals. Let me focus on the House cuts and just broadly make a few comments about those in the Senate, and then a couple of comments on the special revenue funds. If you look at the numbers on in the cuts on the House side, they're substantially deeper than on the Senate side. I've looked at it, and the percentages are in our letter, and the actual FTE cuts are there too. And again, these are these will impact our core functions. The two divisions that are at the center and core of our agency, although I'd have to say it's an interesting dynamic in that these two service the rest of the department. So consumer protection, our investigations unit, and the licensing unit, if you will, assist the rest of the department. And as well, so does the administration division. So imagine, if you will, what the administration division is. It's the chief financial officer. It's the technology and information center. It's the human resources. And it's our internal controls operation. It's really the heart and mind of the Department of Commerce in terms of servicing the rest of the staffing. I'd also like to remind members about the recent OLA reports, making sure that we keep track of our internal controls in the process. In the market assurance area, again, this is market assurance's enforcement, consumer protection. These are investigators and our insurance product filings. The cuts to that department or that division in the House budget is what, and if they're spread, if you assume and it's spread across roughly that area, would represent a 20% to 30% reduction in our ability to do consumer protection and enforcement activity. In a nutshell, out of 100 investigations that we do or consumer complaints that we handle, we would be doing 20 to 30 less. We also, let me just focus also on the Senate side. And in the Senate uniquely, in order to achieve the budget cuts, looked at and cut the core management of the department, again, the administrative services. And again, let me just step back and say, make a broad statement. We understand the situation and challenges and the ability or our effort to achieve reductions in the climate that we're in. But going too far in one area will have a severe impact that should be balanced out to the extent that you can do that. Let me comment then, if you would, just on two of the special revenue funds that are significant. Actually, all of them are significant, but let me just focus on two of them. Keep in mind the Insurance Fraud Prevention Unit. The Insurance Fraud Prevention Unit cuts are cuts to staffing in our division. That unit is currently in dire straits in terms of cash flow. Over the last few years, there's already been $3 million in cuts or funds that were taken from this fund. So any further cuts will have an impact on our staffing in doing insurance fraud investigation. And then the second fund I'd like to call your attention to and highlight, and I think needs to be balanced and considered when you're looking at the numbers, and that is the assigned risk plan. In a nutshell, the assigned risk plan is insurance of last resort, as you know, for workers' compensation. And I would just caution and ask you to exercise caution not to impair the claim solvency of this fund. For example, on the Senate side, there are cuts in the second year that we would be careful doing and actually ask that those not happen. They're not, from our perspective, should not be booked at this point because they're uncertain and because we don't know what those numbers would look like in the second year. So those are the two major funds that we would highlight and focus on. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll just leave it at that. My staff, let me just say this, is available to you and the committee members and looking at the numbers, discussing the impact of those numbers, and then as well, we'll be available as we do this.
Thank you, Commissioner Rothman. Questions? Commissioner Rothman, I have one question. You talked specifically about the assigned risk plan. The way that's designed, it's set that the rates are set that they would be with the book rate. And unfortunately, the reality in the industry, I think back to my landscape days, and I remember a rate of $8.07, and that's based on $100 of payroll. At that time, I remember a rate of that. But I was very proud of the fact that my net rate I was paying was in the $4-some-cents range with the not only the experience mod, which I would imagine these folks are subjected to, but you would get a volume discount, and then the private insurance carrier would say, well, you got an experience mod of 68 basis points. We're going to further discount that. It seems this assigned risk plan, the way it's set up, it's just set up to generate millions of dollars into the state coffers at the expense of poor private, many times small business persons, people that are operating within the law, getting work comp insurance. But the net effect is they're paying a rate that seems to be substantially higher. And it just seems to me, I understand you're questioning whether $15 million is right. I actually think that's the excess that's there for sure because of the way we're taking this money. If I'm not mistaken, we took a significant, and I'm trying to remember, in Representative Rukavina's bill 2 years ago, it was in excess, I believe, of 10, and I can't remember if it was what it was, but it was a significant, and already this thing has developed huge balances in it. It seems to me like it's not a very fair system. And I understand we're taking it because it's there, but I'm questioning how the system is really designed. I don't know if you're familiar with how that works and the why of it.
Generally, and I can't speak to how things were done in the past in terms of taking money from the fund. But as you know, the assigned risk plan is for workers' comp policies where you can't get in the regular arena. So let me just answer the question, the question from one perspective that I have, and that is the solvency of that. My responsibilities as commissioner is to make sure that these plans, these assigned risk plans, are solvent and they maintain an adequate amount of funding to pay the claims. So to answer your question, to the extent there is excess, it's excess. Is it unfair? The question is also comes up in all the other, systems that we run in terms of whether or not you need what the funding is in terms of covering the liabilities. And at times there may be excess and there may not be, and it's not necessarily always a specific science. But the goal is to make sure that you're operating to be able to pay back those liabilities. To the extent that there are excesses, and because this money is there, I understand the money has been taken before. Where I'm at is cautioning going too far so that we are unable to pay those liabilities that are already booked, as well for those that are not booked for the second part of the biennium, so that we don't have inadequate amount of funding to pay those claims.
Well,
Mr. Chair, I will take a look at the system, the actual underlying system. You know, we can talk about that, but at this point, I'm looking at the numbers.
Okay, and Commissioner, I appreciate that, and I would recommend that your staff works with our fiscal staff, that we have an understanding of what we expect balances to be. But I also would ask your staff, I mean, this is one we're talking about tens of millions of dollars. I don't know if Mr. Reinholtz or the Senate fiscal staff remembers, but do you happen to remember that in Representative Rukavina's bill, I can't remember if it was 10, 18 million that we ended up doing. It was a significant number, and it was just 2 years ago in tough times. So I hope we'll look at this, because these are folks, you know, we're not talking about a couple hundred thousand dollars here. These are significant amounts of money, as you said, to people that they're not getting the regular insurance. They're having to go to the government to buy insurance. The design was we didn't want that to be set up to get a better rate for them, but I think that's not the situation. So thank you,
Commissioner. I understand. I understand, Mr. Chair, and we're happy to work with you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Senator Dames.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Rothman, this is more of a comment than a question, but in the Senate Commerce Committee, we talked thoroughly in length about our concerns, too, about the Insurance Fraud Fund and the Assigned Risk Plan and some of these other funds, and we really felt that we need to be taking a look at those and determine what funds are going in there. Because as Chairman McNamara referred to earlier about the growth inside these funds seems to be growing at quite a rapid rate. So just to point out, I think we do need to be taking a look at these funds and how we're currently accruing those funds and the value of those funds and possibly look at redoing some of the funding that we do on those.
Commissioner Rothman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dames, I know that there may be some folks in the audience who would have specific interest in discussion as to the value of those funds. And they have come and they have spoken to me as well. I would say this, that we're uncomfortable with using these funds to balance the budget. Second, there are some funds here, or there are some special funds here that go to worthy causes for what they do and for what they this money has been designated to go to some very good things. You can see that there's funding that goes to the deaf, blind, hard of hearing. There's funds that are for energy conservation programs that will help us conserve energy, which is important. There's the auto theft prevention fund where the stakeholders will tell you that those people, actually cops, prosecutors in Minneapolis and St. Paul, will tell you that that money has been well spent because auto theft in those two cities has dramatically declined. Now they'll speak; they've told me that. So I would say that's a good thing to look at, and of course, we'll leave it to further discussion in the committee as to what to do, what the committee will do about that.
Senator Dames.
Mr. Chair, follow up. Just to clarify, Commissioner Rothman, I was not indicating or alluding to that we should be getting rid of these funds. We feel they're very important funds. We just question the formula on how the funds are funded.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner Rothman, I apologize because one of my significant roles here on this conference committee is for the commerce section. I was in the hall dealing with another matter when you were giving your testimony, but I understand it. I mean, I've read the letter. And I just wanted to say that so members are aware that really these different fund transfers were split, or actually the commerce section, as you know, is split between Senator Rosen's energy and telecom piece and then what we did with market assurance, financial institutions, and such in our commerce committee. And what I had said then in the committee with these funds is that I think that in many instances that revolving funds are carve-outs that maybe are not an effective financing or funding mechanism for these, because it doesn't seem to matter whether who the governor is or who's in control of the legislature. We end up always taking this money, and I agree with you 100%. I'm more than uncomfortable by having to do these fund transfers. I know you said you're uncomfortable, and I think you were being kind. This is very troublesome to me, but we did it. I did it because we had to meet a target, and the alternatives were worse on some of the other things. And we did what we could. I know we'll talk about these going forward in more detail. But the hope was is that any of these transfers, with some exception, but did not completely eliminate the function of what they were for. Now, I know the auto theft prevention one, the amount taken there is problematic. I did have a lot of law enforcement folks come and talk to me, and it seemed actually I'm also wondering if maybe this really shouldn't be part of the public safety jurisdiction, because you know we speak a different language, public safety and commerce, even though it's because it's on insurance policy, that's our linkage here. But my hope would be is that as we go forward in the conference committee and as things move around, that as a matter of principle, restoring these funds I think is important. Otherwise, we are clearly admitting that these are failed funding mechanisms, and maybe we should look at maybe just getting rid of them. And that seems maybe a radical alternative, but we just keep taking the money, and is the job getting done it was designed to? Or maybe they need to compete with general fund dollars like other things. And I don't know the long-term answer on that, but Commissioner, you're right that we shouldn't be doing this, but it's the other alternatives were worse. And I appreciate you and your staff as we put these together and working with us in trying to limit the impact on these.
Commissioner Rothman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Gerlach, I appreciate your comments, and I just wholeheartedly echo them as well. They are troublesome to me as well, and we look forward to working with you on as you go forward and trying to figure out what you're going to do.
And Commissioner Rothman, Representative Hoppe, who chairs our Commerce Committee, is actually has his committee meeting today to meet deadline, but like Senator Gerlach, they're both expertise and interest in this area is, we'll hope you'll bring them involved in the process as we work on. They were very good comments, Senator Gerlach. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, just kind of focusing on one of the funds you mentioned, that insurance fraud prevention fund. Under the Senate paragraph there, you use, and I quote, it says it would make it impossible for the unit to perform its duties. Does that mean you'd end up just laying those folks off then, or?
Commissioner Rothman.
Mr. Chair, there's certainly risk of that as well. It severely impairs the cash flow of our unit.
Senator Peterson.
I like your comment that severely imposes their cash flow, but that's different than impossible. I mean, to me, impossible means that the job won't get done, and then you know, what do those folks do if they can't operate? That's what I'm wondering, what those staff would end up doing, I guess. So.
Commissioner Rothman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, I can only tell you, you know, from that the supervisor of that unit and his fear in not being able to accomplish his duties that were given to him in that unit, and those are his express words. It will make it difficult and nearly impossible. So they are very concerned about the cuts in that area.
Thanks.
Thank you, Commissioner Rothman. I don't see any other questions, but I do just one for myself. Are you empowered from the governor to come forward here and represent him and negotiate on his behalf?
You know, Mr. Chair, on that, the governor speaks for himself. I work, obviously, for the governor. I will be advising him from, you know, our perspective in terms of what the impacts are. Our staff is fully available to all of you to ask all the questions and all that. And in terms of speaking to you about the impacts, absolutely. In terms of where we go from here, you know, I just say that it's the governor's office and us together that will be working on the numbers and the process as you go forward.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. I would strongly recommend you have a conversation with him that we need you to be here to represent him. You are his commissioner of commerce, and we've got commerce in this conference committee, and we've got to have somebody who's going to speak and work towards getting the deal done. So rather than go around in circles, we'd like to be able to move ahead. And we appreciate your comments and take them very serious, because this is a tough time. These are significant changes proposed, and we need to keep doing the good things that your department's doing. Thank you for making time. We really appreciate you making time to come to the conference committee today and to take this process seriously.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, we're going to take about a five-minute recess, and then Director Jasky will come up. We're going to be in recess for about 5 minutes.